Our friends from Healthy Bud just launched a new exciting product, and our dog Zippo has been absolutely obsessed. Their mini training treats are packed with superfoods like lion's mane, reishi, and salmon oil to support brain health. And with over 500 treats per bag and just one calorie per treat, you can rest assured that you're providing guilt-free taste and nutrition in every bite. To grab a bag yourself or a few, head over to us.healthybud.co and use our code FP20 to save 20% on your first order.
The Family Pups Podcast. As you know, this is where we have conversations about the most commonly requested dog training and dog behavioral issues. And today's topic is about training methods, and in particular, positive reinforcement training methods, which Tanya uses exclusively. And we'll talk more about what positive reinforcement is, in addition to all these other methodologies that other dog trainers use as well. And so let's talk about this for a second.
But before you continue, I just wanted to add on that I actually sometimes do use negative punishment as well. So negative punishment is removing something that the dog perceives as valuable or something that is maintaining a behavior in order to decrease it. So the most common example is if your dog is jumping up at you in order to get your attention, when you remove your attention, let's say, and kind of turn around when the dog jumps at you, the dog over time is going to learn that in order to get your attention, they need to offer a different behavior. And obviously, main goal is to actually focus on teaching an alternative behavior and how exactly we would like them to ask for our attention rather than the jumping. But it is something that I may need to implement.
So let's talk about some of your conversations with clients or prospective clients on training methods. Obviously, if they want exclusive positive reinforcement training for their dog, that's an easy conversation to have with you. But I'm sure you've had some conversations where some people might say, I don't like hurting my dog, but for this reason, I'm almost forced to use these methods. What are some of the kind of main justifications people use?
Mm-hmm. Well, I do find that it can be more difficult to be positive than negative. Obviously, when we are upset, frustrated, angry, it can be easy to resort to a punisher. And for us as humans, it comes out more easily and more naturally than actually, you know, taking a breath and thinking over the situation and what we can do different. I do think that the positive approach to training is a philosophy itself, and it's a practice. And it's a practice that happens over time. It doesn't mean that we'll always be perfect. My goal is to paint the picture for my clients that what we're going to do with the training is really focus on teaching the dog what we want them to do in the situations where we are experiencing the undesirable behavior. So instead of focusing on or waiting for the dog to do something wrong that then we are going to punish, we are going to start teaching the dog our alternative and incompatible behavior. And this is really going to be our focus. An example that I like to give is, let's say you were learning how to dance, let's say a new dance, salsa or bachata or something, right? You're there, you're vulnerable, you need to learn to move your body in a new way. And imagine that every time you take a few steps or you were trying to get into the groove of the dance, the teacher came to you and told you, no, you're doing it wrong. Stop doing that. Now, you will be very confused, most likely frustrated, and really unsure about what exactly you should be doing instead of the thing that you're doing wrong. So I want us as good teachers to get into the practice of looking at a situation and kind of drawing from this well of behaviors that we're teaching our dogs. They don't have to be that many, but they can be a few that they know how to do very well. And then using those behaviors in situations where we're seeing something we don't like.
Yeah, I find there is a little bit of a discrepancy between some people who are vegan. They eat organic food. They believe in animal conservation. But for some reason, it persists that despite all of that, I'm going to use aversive training methods on my dog. And so, you know, kind of going back to the question earlier, what are people saying to kind of justify of like, I don't want to do this, but in these certain circumstances, my hand is almost being forced. Like, what are you hearing there?
Well, I think oftentimes we may be influenced from an early age. I don't want to do this, but this is how we did it when I was growing up. This is what I saw from this TV personality, and they were able to fix the dog. This is what I saw my neighbor do. This is what I saw when I Googled it. So I'm really desperate, and this is what I'm going to try to do as well. I think oftentimes it comes from a place of, hey, I have this issue and it's really bothering me, so I am going to do everything in my power to help resolve it. And obviously a lot of people have a lot of opinions about dog training, and also, unfortunately, the dog training field is an unregulated field. And this was a recent experience that we had, right? Someone reached out and they called themselves a dog behaviorist. But when you look at the About Me page, let's say, for example, there is no certifications, no courses taken, nothing at all, which is a little bit of an offense towards the dog behaviorists who have actually taken many years to study and to get their certificates. So anyone can really call themselves a dog expert, dog trainer, dog behaviorist. And there we really do have a lot of conflicting advice and point of view of what should be done in certain situations.
And that's why we wanted to have our conversation today with our guest, because what is the science saying? And so our guest today is Anna Caterina Vieira de Castro. She has a BSc degree in biology and a PhD in experimental psychology, and is currently a researcher at I3S, the Institute for Innovation and Research in Health at the University of Porto, Portugal. She has been carrying out scientific research on animal learning and behavior since 2008, and more recently has focused her work on canine welfare and behavior. Her recently completed postdoctoral project, where she investigated the effects of training methods on the welfare of companion dogs and their bond with their owner, aroused great interest in the scientific community, in addition to us, as well as prominent media coverage at an international level. Caterina has also worked as a dog trainer and is passionate about dog sports. So, without further ado,
Let's
jump into it. So, introducing and welcoming Anna Caterina Vieira de Castro to the podcast.
It's working?
Yeah, it's okay. Working great.
Perfect.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How about you?
Us too.
Yeah, we're doing well. I noticed in your bio, you called yourself Caterina. Do you go by Caterina or you go by Anna?
Caterina.
Okay.
Yeah.
Caterina. Okay.
Yeah, here in Portugal, we have several names. Yeah. It's very common to have like two first names, and then people, usually your fathers, your parents decide to call you by one name.
Yeah.
And at school, then people call you by other name and it's a mess, but that's how it goes.
The majority of people call you Katerina, though, in your life.
In my life, if they are close friends or people working closely with me, because if I go, like my teachers at school or so, it was always Anna because it's the first name. So it's the first that they usually use. If asked, I would go with Katerina.
Katerina, great. So welcome to the podcast, Katerina Vieira de Castro. Yeah. We're so happy to have you here. So let's just jump right into it. In your research paper, "Does Training Methods Matter? Evidence for the Negative Impact of Aversive-Based Methods on Companion Dogs," you mentioned that you studied dogs that were being trained from schools that were using either rewards-based methods, aversive-based methods, or mixed methods. Could you give our audience a sense of how you defined what a rewards-based training school looked like, a aversive-based training school looked like, and a mixed training school looked like? How'd you define those?
Okay. I think regarding this question, I will give you two answers. One more technical, but then one that can be easier for our listeners to actually understand how it was to how actually this training looks like. But so for scientific purposes, we actually went with video recording these training sessions. And then we used the operant conditioning techniques definitions of positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement, positive punishment, and negative punishment. And we were actually analyzing the videos to see how many times did the trainers or owners at these schools were using each of these principles of operant conditioning. And then we made a first decision, which was to classify a school as reward-based. They wouldn't be allowed to use positive punishment or negative reinforcement. So this was mandatory for the school to be classified as reward-based. Whereas aversive-based and mixed, they could use all the four quadrants of operant conditioning. But then we noticed that we had two really different proportions of aversive stimuli being used. So we had two schools that used on average a proportion of 80% of aversive techniques. So they were punishing the dogs or negatively reinforcing the dogs around 80% of the time and only rewarding 20% of the time. And then we had other schools that used a way lower proportion of aversive based stimuli, around 20%. So actually they were using aversives as well, but in a really, really, really lower proportion, okay? Mm-hmm. And so this was how we defined. So for reward-based, no positive punishment or negative reinforcement allowed. And then for schools that used all the four quadrants of operant conditioning, we had those using positive punishment and negative reinforcement in high proportions. These were the aversive-based group. And then two schools using low proportions of aversive-based techniques. And so these were the mixed group. I don't know how familiar our listeners will be with these concepts of operant conditioning, because I can give a brief explanation of what they are about.
Yeah, that'll definitely get to be my next question. Can you just give a brief summary of those four quadrants and what those kind of entail?
Okay, so first of all, this is basically about teaching dogs or training dogs through consequences of their behaviors. Okay, so operant conditioning is about this. You perform a behavior and you are either punished or rewarded, and as a function of this, consequence, then your behavior increases or decreases in frequency. And so, and the terms here, positive and negative, people are a lot of times confused by the use of the terms positive and negative, because in this context, it doesn't mean, positive doesn't mean good and negative doesn't mean bad. It just means that, so positive means that something was added as a consequence of your behavior. Mm-hmm. And this can be, for example, a treat. So a dog sits and receives a treat. So we are adding a stimulus to the environment, to the dog. And so this is positive reinforcement. So positive because the treat was added, and reinforcement because this behavior will be likely performed in the future. Of course, if the dog sees this as a reward. But for example, a dog can be pulling on the leash, and I can add a stimulus, which is, for example, a leash jerk on a pinch collar. And this is already, I'm adding as well, so it's positive, but most likely it will be a punishment because this will decrease the behavior of the dog pulling. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I'm already mixing here some examples to make it, try to make it a bit clearer. And so for the negatives, we have a situation where a behavior results in the removal of something. An example of negative punishment, which is used by reward-based trainers, is that you remove something that the dog wants to punish a behavior. For example, when we have a puppy that is nipping a lot, that is biting a lot, and we are playing with a puppy, interacting with a puppy, we can punish this behavior just by removing our attention or the play we are performing with the dog. Okay, mm-hmm. So this is punishment. It's negative because we remove something, but it's allowed, let's say, for the reward-based trainers because it doesn't involve any type of physical or emotional mm-hmm. confrontation with the animal. Okay. And then finally, we have the negative reinforcement, which is, in this case, removing something that is unpleasant for the dog as a consequence of a behavior. Mm-hmm. For example, we have a dog that is, we can give again the example of pulling on a leash. And the dog, imagine, is in a choke chain and the dog is pulling. And because it's pulling, he's feeling this discomfort. And as soon as the dog stops pulling, this discomfort is removed. Okay, so we are removing something negative, but the behavior of not pulling will increase in the future. Okay, so we are talking about reinforcement, and so these are already some examples of the techniques we were seeing in the school. So I can tell you very briefly, for example, in an aversive based school, you would see mainly teaching dogs to walk on a leash by using leash jerks, and stays, for example, training the dog to stay with some intimidation, like you say the dog, you command the dog to stay and the dog gets up and you go there and like kind of intimidate the dog. But then, okay, if in the end the dog performs well, you add a treat to it or sometimes a pet. Okay, mm-hmm. You stroke the dog. Within mixed method schools, you would be pretty much seeing already the basic behaviors being trained using reward-based techniques like luring, targeting. So training the dog to sit by following the hand, to lay down by following the hand. But then you would sometimes see, for example, for leash pulling, maybe they use a pinch collar. Okay, but always followed by treats. So you would give a small pinch to the dog, but immediately reward the dog as well for mm-hmm. performing the correct action. So this would be more or less, and with less intimidation. So I think that would be the best description for this. And for reward-based schools, you would be pretty much seeing dogs and owners trying to lead the dogs to perform the behaviors using food for and luring to train the dog to sit, to lay down, reward a lot, for example, for the stay, so that the dog understands that it has to stay. So in the beginning, you reward a lot for the dog by remaining in position. Mm-hmm. So more in a way that you don't let the dog unsucceed, at least a lot of times, although of mm-hmm. course unsuccess and failure is also part of the learning process, but really focused in a way where, okay, let's try to prevent the dog from failing and actually reward the dog from succeeding. So I don't know if you guys think this is clear enough or if I should.
Yeah, that was very clear for sure.
You think it? Yeah.
Yeah, okay, and definitely the positive and negative and quadrants can be confusing, but that's something that we understood very well. I mean, what would you say your interest in this topic like, where did that come from? What kind of spurred you on to do this kind of research?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because it actually came from my direct contact with dog training. And when I started having this involvement with NGOs, and so I found the need to get some training on how, on dog behavior, on dog body language, dog training. And I actually got very enthusiastic about it. And I soon started to understand that there were very different philosophies among dog trainers. And a heated debate all the time about whether this method is good, whether this method is efficient, what we should do, what we shouldn't do. And people were so certain of their of what they were saying. And then I was already starting to do my PhD back then as well. And I started to do a bit of research, and I saw, okay, science doesn't really have an answer for this. So we are debating and discussing based on our own opinions and on what we think our eyes are seeing. But I would actually like to know whether using an e-collar in a certain way is actually stressful for the dog. Mm-hmm. Whether, okay, it's very really good. It's really good if we can train a dog with zero stress. But is this efficient? Can we actually reach certain goals or correct some behaviors with this type of training?
Right.
And I couldn't find the answers to this question. Just a lot of people and books and TV shows saying that this is better. No, this is better. And then, yeah, definitely that was what led me to actually want to pursue with this type of research.
Yeah, that's a good lead into my next question, which is, you mentioned that there were prior studies and that determined that aversive-based methods were linked to compromised dog welfare. And we can go into what dog welfare is and how you define that, but you said that a review of these studies determined that firm conclusions could not be drawn from them. So in your own words, what were the limitations of those studies, and how did those limitations inform how you designed this study?
Okay. That's where we started our research. It was actually to perform a literature review on the theme, because that's usually where you start in science. So let's see what's the state of the art. Let's see what science has currently to say. And so we went into designing this literature review, and we found some studies, not a lot. So first of all, there were not that many studies on this topic. And then you can say that it's not easy to study these kind of questions in the first place. So just for you to have an idea, it took me 3 years to collect the data for this study. Okay. So this is actually... And you have to have the involvement of the trainers, you have to have the involvement of the owners, you have to spend a lot of time actually in the field collecting data. Then you have dropouts, because some people start in the training schools and then they give up. Some mm-hmm. start with your study, but then they don't want to pursue with it anymore.
Right.
So it actually takes a lot, even from your emotional part. What we could see, me and my colleagues, my co-workers, in this literature review was that we had few studies, and a lot of them were not actually objectively measuring dog welfare. So they were mostly based on questionnaires. And the thing is that here with questionnaires, you have a big problem to start with, which is it's difficult for you to determine if it's causation or correlation. And by this I mean, imagine I ask you whether your dog has some anxiety problems, and you say yes. And in the same questionnaire, I ask you about some training methods that you used to train that dog. And in the end, I find that, okay, I have a lot of dogs with anxiety whose owners or tutors have used a lot of aversive-based methods. But in this type of questionnaires, you don't know what came first. Is it that these tutors were using more reward aversive based methods because their dogs were already anxious or aggressive, or was it the other way around? And on top of this, you have subjectivity. Sometimes we know it's not very easy for people to give you an objective answer on, because at least here in Portugal, it's very clear that most people don't really know how to read a dog, and they don't really master like the reading of a dog in order to so that they know that the dog is not stressed or is okay. It's and this is something it takes some time to master actually. Mm-hmm. And so when you go to seeing that a lot of studies are relying on questionnaires, you have these two big problems coming in. And so for sure, objective measures of welfare, which we can talk in what follows, are definitely needed. Like you need to see it through objective measures and not from what people may think. People may be biased by several reasons that we don't know. And so this can actually impact and mask what's actually there existing, okay? And this was one main limitation. And then we found others, like, for example, only one or two studies were conducted in companion dogs. So most studies had been conducted in lab dogs or in military dogs. And like the training regimes of these dogs are pretty much very different from our companions. And even their genetic, because usually lab dogs are beagles and military police dogs are Malinois or German Shepherds. Mm-hmm. Even the genetic of the dog, and we know that the breeds are different in their behavior. And so they may also react differently to different training methods, okay? And also another thing was that pretty much all these studies focused on e-collars. E-collars are like that tool that actually make people very nervous and that actually cause a lot of debate. Mm-hmm. But it's just one tool on the middle of a lot of aversive-based techniques that can be used. Mm-hmm. And so this all informed actually our study. We wanted with this study to overcome all these limitations. So we wanted to have a study where we could objectively assess what were the training methods that were being used. And to this, we recorded the training sessions so that we can have like an objective measure of, I know how many times this trainer used punishment. I know how many times this trainer used positive reinforcement, even the type of if it was food, if it was play, if it was praise. We also didn't use questionnaires. We actually went to assess the welfare of the dogs, okay? And we can go into detail on this just after I talk a little bit about how we overcame the other two problems. Mm-hmm. Which was, of course, we wanted to cover companion dogs. Let's focus on companion dogs and let's embrace the variability of breeds, ages, all the variability. We really embraced it in this study. Like we want to cover what's out there, what's the real world for companion dogs, okay? And once again, of course, we didn't only focus on e-collars. We focused on a variety of techniques, even in a variety of the proportion of aversive techniques that were being used.
Let's quickly talk about those objective measures. So obviously you wanted to measure dog welfare. And so what were those objective measures you kind of keyed in on to measure how the dog felt either in the training environment or, as we'll talk about later, after the training environment?
So basically, we wanted to make this like a really strong study. And also something that we saw in previous studies that they were mainly assessing. So those that were objective studies, which were very limited. So those that were not using questionnaires, those that were actually trying to take some objective measures of welfare, they just did it during the training context. Okay, and we know, of course, that you can be stressed by a certain event. I mean, I can imagine that the dog can be stressed by some punishments being applied. But welfare is more than this. So welfare is more than just that stress that you can feel there in those seconds, in those minutes. Welfare is a more, it's a broader concept that nowadays actually embraces also the fact that animals should also have positive experiences for to be in a good welfare. Mm-hmm. So because some years ago you would see that welfare was mainly focused on, okay, so let's avoid negative experiences for animals. And this was a concept widely used in farm animals, for example. So, okay, let's limit the stress these animals are feeling. Let's provide them with food and water and good health care and some space, some shelter, some opportunities for them to express at least some natural behaviors. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, we are seeing more and more this shifting to an approach where you also want the animal to have positive experiences. So something that it's not only about not suffering, it's also about living a life that's worth living.
Sure. Okay?
And here, of course, I mean, going back to where I was in my reasoning, you can have a few stressful situations, but you can cope with it and that's fine. The major problem with welfare is when these experiences start to be cumulative and they actually start to affect your emotional, more long-term emotional states. So one thing is to be afraid because there was a storm today. Another thing is being exposed to punishments every day, and this will probably result in a generalized anxiety state for an animal.
Sure.
And so in this study, we wanted to check so what's happening during the training session, what's the immediate reaction of the animal to the training methods, but also if this carried over to the animal's daily life, daily emotional state. Okay. And so we combined behavior, physiology, and cognition. So three ways of assessing welfare. During the training sessions, we video recorded these training sessions, and besides being able to analyze objectively what were the training techniques that were being used, we could also see exactly which and how many stress behaviors were these dogs performing. And we know that dogs perform behaviors such as lip licking, yawning, shaking, like avoidance behaviors, moving away from the trainer, crouching, paw lifting. So we built an ethogram, which is a list of these behaviors that are part of the dog's repertoire. And we were analyzing each training session, how many of these behaviors were these dogs performing.
That sounds like a lot of evidence collection, a lot of pausing of videos and everything.
Yeah, for you to have an idea, we have like we recorded 15 minutes of training of each training session for each dog. But when you go to analysis, some of these videos of 15 minutes took us like 2 hours to analyze. Because you really go in slow motion because you don't want to miss a lip leak. Sometimes you have to go back to check if that actually happened. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, especially if the dog is under a lot of stress, there are like 4 or 5 behaviors happening at the same time, mm-hmm. like a crouch, a head turn, a lip leak. And so, yeah, that's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And lot of hours if you multiply that by so we videotaped 3 training sessions per dog, and we had nearly 100 dogs in the study. So mm-hmm. It was a lot of and that's why we also need some I had really nice and committed students by the time that are also co-authors in this study.
Yeah,
that without them we couldn't have done all this data analysis for sure.
Mm. And shout out to your students for sure.
And they will like this because one of them is actually from the US, so I'm pretty sure she will be delighted to listen to this podcast afterwards.
Okay, great.
Yeah, that's great because the other podcast I have is in Portuguese, so I'm pretty sure she was here for 4 months. I don't think she will be able to understand the Portuguese version.
Okay. Do you want to shout her up by name right now?
Yeah, she's Danielle Fuchs. Okay. She was here. She was doing her master's in the University of Edinburgh, but she actually came here to her dissertation. All right. Yeah, and we have also Stefania Pastur, which was an Italian student by the time. And she helped a lot as well in the beginning of the study, for sure. So names that should be pronounced here for sure. And okay, and then together with these behavior measures, so and this, of course, these behavior measures are measures of these immediate responses to immediate stress responses that I was talking about. So probably if you intimidate a dog, if you hit a dog, if you scream to a dog, you will see a lot of these immediate reactions. Okay. But we wanted to add also a physiological measure of stress. And so for this, we use cortisol. Cortisol is a hormone that is released when we are under stress conditions. And what we did was to ask the owners to collect saliva samples at home so that we could have some baseline levels of cortisol, because this can vary a lot between dogs. And so we asked them to collect saliva samples at home in days where no training was performed. And these were our baseline samples. So this would pretty much be the basal stress level of each of these animals. And then we also collected saliva samples after the training sessions. So the idea here was to see whether this hormone would increase in saliva after the training experience as compared to their basal levels that were found at home. So and cortisol is a bit tricky too, so you can't, when you only use cortisol, well, it can also be released a bit like adrenaline, it can also be released in positive stress situations. Let's say. So it's tricky to interpret it. That's why it's so important to have it in parallel with, for example, stress-related behaviors. Mm-hmm. Because for these stress-related behaviors, we know it's their valence. They mean the animal is in a negative stress situation, okay? Because, if you just look at... We could have high levels of cortisol. If, for example, the dogs were playing a lot during training sessions, that could happen. Mm-hmm. But when you put one thing next to the other and you see, okay, I have high levels of cortisol... And the dog is showing a lot of avoidance behavior. This is most likely this stress, so mm-hmm. negative stress and not excitement, okay?
Well, in your conversations with aversive-based schools and trainers, did you get the sense from them that they know that they are causing their dog stress, but to your point, it's not going to be long-lasting stress, and that was kind of their justification for causing this stress during the training process? What was their justification in your mind that made it okay in their mind?
Okay, that's really like you are raising a lot of questions that I'm going to address in studies I'm starting now.
It's well, I want credit in your paper now.
Because that's actually something we have already planned and we are already starting some of that research, because we really want to go. I mean, I had some informal conversations with trainers, so I can have, and I had different justifications, different opinions, and we can talk briefly about that. But we want to have this data collected. We really want to go into detail in interviewing dog trainers to actually know what makes up their decision making about dog training and what leads you to choose these methods, and if they are aware of welfare issues, if they are aware of efficacy issues, if they balance these two things, because this is really interesting to know.
Well, we were talking about we were talking about that too, and we were wondering if there was a connection in the parenting style of their parents and then the ultimate training methods that they use for their dogs. There might be some correlation there. I think that's interesting. Yep.
Pretty sure. I'm pretty sure that is. But yeah, something I also have in my studies to come.
Okay.
I had a proposal to actually try to to match to investigate the parenting styles of the tutors, okay, and correlate that with the training methods they end up choosing, which is also something that is important to study, because we also don't know what leads owners to choose a given training method.
Sure.
From my informal conversations here, I got the feeling that most people didn't even know there were different methods to train dogs.
Yeah.
And they were just choosing the school because it was closest to their place, or because someone there knew someone referenced
recommended
that school.
It, yeah.
So this is a nice school. I was there with my dog, so
yeah.
And it was nice, so so still a lot. This is actually a really interesting area, because there's so many answers to give. It's so many stuff to do research on, so that we can actually have all this picture of what's going on in dog training, what leads to this all scenario that we are seeing right now. But yeah, for trainers I have different approaches. Comments. I would say that some people are not even aware of the impact this may have on dog welfare.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, aversive or highly aversive training methods. Some other people will tell me, well, I know this may cause some stress, but I have results. And I don't believe people can have the same results by not using at least some punishment.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But I really aim to investigate this more in detail in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting, because for me, as obviously using positive reinforcement techniques, some time ago I observed training being done, and it was definitely aversive based. So they were trying to teach the dog to stay by, you know, saying stay, and then when the dog would get up, they would spank the dog. And it really, to me, just as an observer, it just didn't seem right. It seemed like it was a bit of an animal abuse. So it kind of made me feel distressed, and I did ask them not to hit the dog as I was walking by. But again, it's just, as you were saying, it's so interesting to see where people are coming from and what their reasoning is for doing that. And, you know, obviously the comments that I got back were, hey, this is a real bad dog and you don't understand. This is what we need to do in order to train this dog. And, you know, this is how it was. But to see it was a little bit stressful to be the observer of the situation.
I can relate for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean not all aversive based training looks as bad. You can, I've watched a lot of training sessions with aversive I mean, in the end they were fair to the dogs, you know. It's not like, especially the mixed approach,
mm-hmm.
you first explain to the dog what you want from him,
uh-huh.
and then eventually you apply some punishments, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And of course this is completely different from you expect that the dog understands what the stay means.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just start spanking the dog. I wouldn't even call that training, but that's, I don't know, another discussion.
Yeah.
Maybe some people won't agree with me. And I don't know the dog. I don't know the specific situation.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, to me, I really think that, you know, sometimes we come at it, again, like last resources. We have an issue and we want it fixed. And even if someone tries aversive approaches, or let's say my dog jumps on me or bites, my puppy bites me, and I decided to spray them with the water bottle. You know, no judgments. If you want to try that approach, I do think that you should try it a few times with the aversive. And then if you're seeing a result and the behavior disappearing, that's great. To me, sometimes the line becomes blurred between just the repetitiveness of doing it again and again, and we know that generally there will be an increase of the aversive stimulus if it's not yielding the same results that we were wanting to achieve. So it's just finding the moral borders or lines between, hey, I wanted to try this and I did, but now I'm going to stop because I see the difference, or I see no difference, or, you know, where exactly is that line?
Yeah, that's a really tricky question, and I'm pretty sure that will depend a lot on the person you ask that. But I mean, what science can say right now, well, it's of course what we saw is that even if used in small proportions, that aversive-based methods can cause stress to the dog. Although, for example, we found that if it's in a mixed approach, for example, we didn't get an increase in cortisol as we did with high proportions of aversive-based methods. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's tricky because it will happen that it will be always, in the end, a moral decision. Mm-hmm. Because even if you think, for example, I see dog training in a way that, like, this is a tool and this has to produce results. And I know some people that don't agree with me, and they say, I would rather never let my dog off leash and never use an aversive. So I would prefer to never use any type of punishment, but at the same time, never have my dog off leash.
Right.
Mm-hmm. For me, I see it the other way around. I mean, I see, of course, there's always a limit. But if you, I think that if you can use some aversives that don't go into causing this long term stress in your dog, mm-hmm. and if that's the only way you can reach a certain reliability of behavior, then maybe this is something that might be considered, that I might consider for my dogs. But of course, if I know, and this for this science still has no answer, if I know that reward-based methods, I can have the same results, mm-hmm. then there's no ethical justification for implying even a little bit of stress.
Of course.
If you can do it stress-free, then there's no justification.
Well, let's go talk about that long-term stress. So you mentioned after the training sessions were over, obviously you were measuring their body language during the training sessions. You were measuring their saliva shortly after the training sessions. So what was your methodology on measuring the effect of long-term stress? What was your way in doing that?
Okay. That's a very interesting test that we did. It's a test that I like a lot. You could go as well with a salivary with a hair cortisol, for example. That's a measure that has been used more and more as an indicator of long-term stress in dogs. But here we went with actually a cognitive approach to this. We actually wanted to see what were the underlying emotional states of the dogs once they were outside this training situation. And for this, we used a paradigm which is called cognitive bias test. And basically, this is a test that measures your decision-making when faced with ambiguous situations. Speaking in simple language, I would say this is basically asking if you would see, for example, this glass that this is almost empty now, but if it was half full, it's basically the same of asking you guys, for example, if you would see it as half empty or half full.
Oh, interesting.
That's the dilemma. Mm-hmm. And we know from literature in humans and in other animals, dogs as well, that when we are in positive emotional states, when we are happy, speaking in simple terms, that we are optimistic and we look at this glass and say, oh, that's half full. Mm. And we know that if the same person or if other people are in more negative emotional states, in states of anxiety, depression, constant fear, that they would look at exactly the same glass and say it's half empty. Mm-hmm. And this is the rationale beyond the cognitive bias test. So it's basically this idea that your emotional state influences your decision making when facing ambiguous situations, and that you will go for more optimistic decisions if you are healthy and happy, let's say, and you go for more pessimistic decisions if you are in a more negative stress, anxiety, emotional state. So how did we translate this into an experiment where we would actually test the dog's reaction? So this can be done in different ways. It has been done, if you guys do some research, you will see that it has already been done in actually several species, even bees. There are some experiments designed to measure emotional states in bees. But with dogs, what we used was a pretty simple one, which was, first of all, to teach these dogs what we call spatial discrimination. So we had our dogs in an experimental room at university. And what we wanted the dogs to learn was that, so they were beyond a barrier and with a handler. And when the handler would bring the dog from behind the barrier, the dog would see one of two situations: a bowl of food on the right side of the experimental room, or on the left side, on like the extremes of the room. And for a given dog, for example, every time the bowl was on the right side, it would have a hot dog in there, and every time it was on the left side, it would be empty. And so we exposed the dog to several trials. So we would let the dog go and to the right bowl, then we would let the dog go towards the left bowl, and so on and so on and so on, until the dogs learned that, okay, there's no point on going to the left side because that one is empty. And you could see that dogs very quickly, like after around 20 repetitions, they start to show you that they know that on the right side there's food, but not on the left side, because we were timing, we were using a timer to check how long did it take to them from the time that the handler set them free to when they reach the bowl. Mm-hmm. And you start to see that they go very quickly to the right side. And when they see that the bowl is on the left side, some just go very slowly, or some, they just stop going at all. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so this is basically we saying to the dog, so this is your world right now, dog. So you know that right is good, there's always food there, and left, yeah, it's not that interesting because the bowl is always empty. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is the training we do, and this is so that next, when we are sure that the dog has learned this discrimination, right and left, that we can present the dog with ambiguous stimulations, so the so-called half empty, half full glass, which would be, for example, now that we know that the dog knows this discrimination, I'm going to place the same bowl, but right in the middle of the room at the same distance from the two extremes. Mm. So the dog knows, okay, right, I know it's food in there. Left, I know there's never food in there. What about this middle one now? Mm. And so here the rationale is, if the dog is in a good emotional state, in a positive emotional state, if he's okay, he will be optimistic and he will run to the middle ball as fast, for example, as he would go to the one that he knows that has food, mm-hmm. to the right one. Whereas if you have a dog in a more negative emotional state, they will be more pessimistic and they will see that middle ball, they will see it as a half empty glass, and they may go there more slowly or even not go there at all. Okay. And so the idea is to give this middle ambiguous stimulus that the dog has never seen before. So a ball in the middle of the room right now. And what's your decision making about mm-hmm. that? Mm-hmm. Do you go there thinking there's food, or do you go there, you don't go there, or you go there slowly, kind of not believing that it will be worth to go there because life won't be nice to you this time. And yeah, here what we found was that dogs that were trained with high proportions of aversive-based methods, they were constantly going slower to this middle bowl mm. than dogs that were trained with reward-based methods. So this means that these aversive-based trained dogs were in poorer emotional states than dogs trained with reward-based methods.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. I mean, if I'm in a positive state, I might just be open to more new experiences overall. But if I'm in a negative state, you know, kind of experiencing something new and novel is not something that I might be interested in, at least at the time. Is that kind of the logic there?
Yeah, it's more, I would say it's more about the way you see the world almost. Not like, how would you, if you would have to bet money on that, would you be, because imagine, if life is constantly bringing you nice stuff, of course you will be more prone to bet that situation will be good.
Yeah.
If life is bringing more stress situations, if you are always failing, having bad experiences, maybe you will be more conservative. And I'm not betting on that because life never smiles to me, you know?
Yeah.
It's more this idea of, if you would have to bet on that, and if you are like, if life brings you good things, you will be more likely to bet that middle ball has something good for you. But
yeah,
if you have always bad experiences, you will be like, yeah, no matter what, I don't care. Yeah. Life never brings me good stuff.
Yeah, we tend to think about this in business terms as well, because we see, you know, as an entrepreneur, you have an idea, you go out, you implement it, and you see some positive results, which in return is going to build your confidence and make you more likely to want to keep building up and implementing new ideas. Obviously, it's a journey of up and down, but if, let's say, you had an idea and you tried one time, two times, three times to implement it and it just wasn't working out, then the chances of you just saying, hey, that's not gonna work out, are that much more higher. Obviously, perseverance is a thing, but in generally speaking, that is a way of kind of being with us humans as well.
Yeah, that's a really good example. Yeah, for sure, that's...
Well, let's talk about your findings. So I know we talked a lot around it and how you designed it. So what were your findings there?
Okay. So first, our hypothesis was built, of course, in previous studies that had their limitations, but they were already pointing to this direction that aversive-based techniques could have some negative impact on dog welfare. But what we did end up finding, of course, main finding, I would say, is that dogs that are trained with aversive-based methods in high proportions, they are facing stress during training sessions. They show much more stress behaviors than dogs trained with reward-based methods. These dogs show increases in cortisol after training as compared to their baseline levels. And even when you go and assess their emotional states outside the training context, they are more pessimistic. So they reveal to be in a worse welfare status than dogs trained with reward-based methods. What we had of interest here as well, in my opinion, were the results for this for the mixed method group, where we saw some stress associated. So still more stress behaviors being displayed during training than when compared with the dogs trained with reward-based methods. But then no differences in cortisol. So we didn't see, although we saw an increase in cortisol, this didn't reach statistical significance. So in science, this means there's no difference. Mm-hmm. Although maybe if you increase more your sample size, maybe we could get some differences there as well in cortisol.
Sure.
Given that we had also the difference in stress behaviors, so we had more stress behaviors. But when you go to the cognitive bias test and looking at whether these dogs are in a worse or better emotional states, we didn't find a difference to reward-based trained dogs. So speaking very briefly, this would mean that using aversives always causes some stress during training for sure. But apparently, our results suggest that this not transferred to your overall daily emotional state. Okay, so this is basically summing up what we found in this study.
Obviously, there's a difference between welfare and efficacy, right? So there are some dogs that have a very specific job to do, whether service dogs, military dogs, police dogs. And they justify a lot of those measures by saying they might feel bad or be stressed out a little bit, but these are methods that are required because they need to do a very specific job with a bunch of different consequences, much like the military might justify very stringent training methods of their soldiers because they're going to go into war, right? And so have you thought about that in terms of welfare versus efficacy?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about it because for me, that's the question, is that balance between one and the other. But here, if the welfare impact of different methods has been little studied, efficacy and efficiency, you have even less. Mm-hmm. You have even less studies. So basically, the answer to the question of which of these methods is more efficient or... you don't know.
Right.
We still don't know.
Yep.
Okay, so this is something we are already also starting to plan one study. We have already what we call a registered protocol out there, which is a proposal of a study, but we didn't start that study yet. But this is a study where we want to, in a very specific context, try to compare the efficacy of different methods. But even this, like, this is all difficult research because then you have different contexts. One thing is to train a working dog, which is probably much more demanding than training a companion dog.
Sure.
So it may be the case that for some specific roles of working dogs, you actually need to use some aversives. I don't know. This is still to be studied. But it may be that for the level that require that level that is demanded for a companion dog to be well behaved, there's no need for that because it's not as demanding. Okay, so it will always be a difficult subject, even though I hope and we aim to be part of this to actually bring more scientific data into these matters. But you will always have a lot of different scenarios that, so a lot of studies will have to be conducted. And one thing also is training your puppy for basic obedience behaviors. A different thing is to try to correct some problematic behaviors,
sure,
such as installed aggression or anxiety or so on. So it's not, I don't believe there will be a general answer saying that, okay, overall there's no difference in efficacy. I'm pretty sure, this is my hypothesis right now, that we will find differences depending on the job or on the behavior that we are aiming to target, because it's different. And it may be that in some cases, yeah, reward-based, because they don't cause stress, should be used only. And maybe in some cases you need some aversives still to be answered.
And what are your thoughts on the effect of the different training approaches on the human end of the leash? Do you think that affects whether you are in a more punishment-based type of mindset or a positive approach? Do you think that affects the human welfare and their relationship with their dogs?
That's an interesting question. First of all, I'm really interested, and we are already starting to collect data in this, on what leads different people to actually choose a different certain approach. Because I've been in contact with a lot of people, especially in dog sports, and you see really different approaches. You see it will be really interesting to actually map what's going on people's minds around this. If it affects your welfare, well, I'm not sure, because that's a complex issue, even to be studied, because you have to do it in a way that you can actually see what is causing what.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And not only a correlation, because it may be that if you are more depressed, more anxious, you don't have that much patience. Mm-hmm. And so it's much easier to just resort to, oh, I want results quickly, or mm-hmm. you are not even training properly. Yeah. Already you are just like punishing your dogs because you are stressed. Yeah. And you shouldn't be doing that.
And I think we know when we're stressed, we're more concerned about short-term results than mm-hmm. long-term ones, because you know our capacity to kind of look that far is much good more point, limited. Yeah. Because you know we're in this flight or flight kind of scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you have a dog at home that is biting you every day, and your patience to accept something that may take more time to fix or to,
of course,
to manage at least, is probably way lower.
Yeah.
So that's why I say it's a very complex issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Very complex.
Yeah.
But I was going to add that regarding the dog owner bond, we actually had, although smaller scale study, but we investigated also, I can say, the quality of the dog owner bond in correlation with the type of training that the dogs were that were being used with those dogs. Mm-hmm. And we found some results pointing to the fact that dogs that were enrolling classes in schools that used reward-based training had a more secure, I can simply say, a better bond with their owners. One where we could see that the dogs were basically using their owners as a secure base. Mm-hmm. And so when the owner was present, the dogs would play more. Yeah. With the toys that were in the experimental room, or even approach a stranger person. And we couldn't see that effect in dogs coming from aversive-based schools. Mm-hmm. So there's already some suggestion that this may also impact the dog owner bond. Although I have to say this was a small sample size, so we can't really infer strong conclusions from here, but it appears to be there some suggestion that yes, this can also affect at least the way the dog sees its relationship to the owner or to the tutor.
So obviously this research took a lot of time, a lot of hours, a lot of preparation. Was there something that you learned that maybe was a little unexpected? What were some findings where you're like, wow, I never thought about it like that?
Well, to be honest, I was surprised because when I started this research, actually in the beginning, we were aiming only at dividing the schools into aversive or reward. Mm-hmm. And what I was surprised to see is that, okay, even if there are people using aversives, but in very different ways, in very different proportions. Mm-hmm. And it ended up being that it may a difference in the dog's welfare. And I saw some training sessions with pinch collars, e-collars, where you could see that the dog was not that stressed. I think that was what surprised me more, because I had this view, even from the trainers when I was younger, they were always using this approach, at least the aversive-based ones. They were really harsh, they were really intimidating to the dogs. It was about choking and hitting and shouting, and then I started to see, okay, there are some people working here in more balanced ways, and I was really curious at the time to see, okay, I want to see actually how this is impacting these dogs' welfare or not. I think for me personally, that was actually the thing that was a bit surprising, and where I learned a lot. It's like, yeah, people work very differently. Mm-hmm. And it's probably not only on the fact that you use aversives, but on how much and how you use them as well.
Well, I think that's a good place to wrap here. Can you let our audience know how they could connect with you? How could they learn more about your work? I would just love to learn more about that.
Yeah, of course. You can, I'm actually preparing a website for my research, but I still don't have it ready. But I can leave my email, which is anna.castro@ibmc.up.pt. This is my professional email. It's also on my research paper. So if you by any chance reach one of my research papers, this is probably the easiest way to contact me. But you can also find me in Facebook, Catarina Vieira de Castro, or Catarina Vieira de Castro in Twitter as well. So if you guys want to, I can send you afterwards. I don't know if you can, maybe you can add it to my bio or
for
so,
sure.
The links, so that I don't know how many Catarina Vieira de Castro are out there. So maybe it's easier to actually have the link to my mm-hmm. Twitter account and to my even to my research, the website that we have for the institute where I work, some of that information.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Because we are really aiming to have this website only dedicated to the research on dogs that mm-hmm. we do, but it's still under construction.
Yep. Well, I wanted to say thank you so much for all the work you're doing on this subject. We were talking at the beginning of the podcast about how so much of our feelings about one training method or another is really based on kind of our own values, and having someone who's so dedicated to providing scientific-backed research on what increases dog welfare or not is so vital for us to really spread the message about, you know, our commitment to positive reinforcement training, about building a true relationship with our dogs rather than one based on complete obedience. We'd love to thank you so much for your hard work, as well as the hard work of all your colleagues and students.
Yeah, and I have to thank you guys a lot for the invitation and for being interested in actually also helping to disseminate our work, because dogs and tutors will be the ones benefiting from it in the end, for sure.
For sure, for sure.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for your time, for really diving deep into this and explaining everything. It was such an interesting subject matter that I'm sure that our audience will get a lot of benefit out of it as well, just to kind of see things from a more science-based and kind of neutral, just let's look at the picture, let's see what the results are. As you were saying, we know there is so much heated debate about this or that, and everyone is just ready at any one point to jump on top of the other with their understanding.
That's exactly the scenario.
Yeah, and that's why we need more of the research and the studies that can just give us some more concrete findings and considerations in improving the conversations when it comes to, obviously, we all love dogs, and that's the thing that connects us as dog trainers, and we want our, you know, we want dogs to do well with their people, and that's why we all do it. So opening the conversation there is important.
Yeah, you would think we're in a world where we're just arguing about everything all the time, that the dog space would be the one place where we would, you know, all hug and, you know, not argue so much. But it seems like there's a lot of arguing in that space as well. But, you know, it can't be helped.
It's the other way around. Unfortunately, But hopefully we will contribute to that. And who knows, maybe in 2 years or so we will be here talking about efficacy. Mm-hmm. Hopefully I will have results by then.
Yeah, we would love to have you back on to talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Make another podcast on it with new data and also update our listeners to the current state of the art.
Yeah, that would be then. Lovely. We'd love that.
Well, thank you so much.
And enjoy the rest of your day.
Enjoy the rest of your
thank
day.
Thank you.
Once
thank
again.
Thank you.
You too. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.
listened to the Family Pups podcast with your hosts, Tanya and Charles Lim. Subscribe to our podcast to catch our latest episodes. If you like the show, please make sure to share and review us on your favorite podcast app. And for links to anything we mentioned in the episode, check out our show notes. And don't forget to visit familypups.com/podcast to listen to past episodes of the Family Pups podcast, including episodes on separation anxiety with Melania DeMartini-Price, unpredictable aggression with Michael Shikashio, fearful dogs with Debbie Jacobs, puppy socialization with Marge Rogers and Eileen Anderson, and many, many more.